Okay, so I'm going to be talking about a pretty broad subject, spiral neutrinos in astrophysics and cosmology. It's going to be mostly cosmology. Unlike the program, I'm yet to actually move to Los Alamos, but I'm still at Fermilab. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me and get a chance to talk about a pretty wacky subject in a way, in fringe astrophysics and cosmology. First of all, what we know about neutrinos and neutrino mass and mixing has changed quite a bit recently, obviously. And surprisingly, we haven't had any phenomenology talks, so I'm just going to review a little bit of phenomenology in terms of four neutrino models and or, you know, n neutrino models. There's no reason to be conservative here. Let's just make an arbitrary number of mass eigenstates, maybe an infinite number, like in the last talk we heard. And what our current picture is that potentially the mass states are populated something like this, where you have the lower mass doublet giving the solar mass splitting, a slightly bigger splitting for the atmospheric neutrinos. And one of the largest motivations for there to be another mass eigenstate, at least one, is the LS&D indications for oscillations. And you could actually do this in a different permutation. You could put in the LS&D mass splitting between, say, the second and third mass eigenstate instead of the third and fourth, and which is then called the 2+2 model. So this need for a new mass scale comes out basically due to the very orders of magnitude difference between the three different delta M squareds in oscillation fits to the three indications for solar atmospheric and LS&D oscillations. And the Z naught width is what requires sterility for the flavor identity that's associated with the fourth mass eigenstate. So sterile neutrinos, this is a pretty odd proposition, but they were around long before LS&D actually even had its indications for oscillations. This is the simplest two neutrino case of introducing a sterile neutrino. You can have a sterile neutrino that appreciably mixes with an active neutrino in this mass term by basically setting this mass matrix where the M sub T and the Majorana terms and the Dirac terms are about the same order of magnitude. The problem then becomes how to make both the active and the sterile light in producing basically the observed light mass eigenstates. But there's extensions, gut extensions of the standard model that can do this apparently. And so despite, you know, their sort of ugly nature and the fact that they're sterile, they can actually do a lot of work in solving problems. So, but they can also actually cause problems, particularly in cosmology. In the early universe, sterile neutrinos are not simply sterile. They can actually become populated through the neutrino mass matrix. So, and mass and mixing. So how does that work? It basically comes out from our understanding of Big Bang nucleosynthesis and the apparent success of it. We heard a really good talk by Gary Steigman on the ability of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and also from David Teitler on this, to predict the light element abundances and the issues involved in all three light elements. But basically, we have two baryometers now in the standard theory to measure the baryon density of the universe. One is the deuterium to hydrogen ratio measured along the line of sight to distant quasars. And this has been done by several, on several objects by more than one group now. And they all basically converge on a relatively low value of deuterium, and which predicts a higher value for eta and basically this previous range for potential values for the baryon to photon ratio. And the new map results, as well as previous indications from other CMB experiments, basically fit right onto this prediction, or this inference for the baryon density. So in a way, the one parameter model of a standard Big Bang nucleosynthesis has become a zero parameter model. It just fits identically with what's expected. So now you can sort of extend the standard BBN to non-standard scenarios that fit that introduce new parameters. So one new parameter would be the number of neutrinos present in the plasma at nucleosynthesis. And so basically, BBNs can be, you can transform BBN from a baryometer to a calorimeter of what's present in the thermal bath in the early universe. And that's exactly what Gary Steigman talked about a couple of days ago, and what you can do with nucleosynthesis now that basically the one free parameter is in the standard theory is gone, in a way. So how this works is, if you have the baryon density given by deuterium or by the CMB, this predicts a value for the helium abundance, and given the observed helium abundance range, you can put a limit on the potential number of neutrinos in the plasma. And so really what you're doing when you measure the primordial helium abundance is you're measuring the energy density of the universe at 1 second. How this works is basically primordial nucleosynthesis occurs in two steps. Yang-Zhong Chen alluded to this earlier. Basically, what you have is a competition between the weak interaction rates and the Hubble expansion rate. And if you introduce a sterile neutrino that's completely thermalized in the early universe, you add more energy density, which increases the expansion rate, which makes weak freeze-out occur at a higher temperature, where these weak rates will actually fall out earlier. You could calculate these weak rates by doing the entire weak matrix elements, or you actually know the difference between the rates in equilibrium, because it's just the Boltzmann factor of the difference between the neutron and proton masses. And so at higher temperature, that Boltzmann factor is less of a difference, and so the weak rates are closer together, and you have more of an equilibrium between neutrons and protons at weak freeze-out, basically more neutrons, which are unfavored due to their higher mass. So what happens is, with a higher neutron to proton ratio, you predict a higher helium abundance, and therefore you have a conflict potentially with the observed helium abundance. So what some work I did last year was basically to take the simplest assumptions about Big Bang nucleosynthesis in the standard case and find out what the effective number of neutrinos predicted or limited by the standard nucleosynthesis is. And basically, this is very similar to what Gary talked about, but we choose slightly different numbers based on different compilations of evidence. I took the cosmological baryon density. You could just take it either from the deuterium abundance or that inferred from the CMB, in this case, from prior to MAP, and given a conservative wide range for the primordial helium abundance, you can put limits on the effective number of neutrinos. And here, in general, it goes from about 1.2 to 3.8. No constraints on what is actually going on with the number of neutrinos in terms of... The CMB, basically, this was the... baryon density range from DAISY plus DMR. Oh, the number of neutrinos, it actually is very similar, a little bit wider because of the uncertainty. You can actually allow for less helium here. So it goes from, let's see here, about 1.4 to 3.4.
So smart from the CMB, especially before MAP, you had almost no restriction.
This is CMB plus helium. This is CMB plus helium. It's a combination of CMB plus BBN. Yeah, so I'm just getting the baryon density. If you don't believe, for instance, if the deuterium is not primordial at high redshift, then this is just another way of getting the baryon density. So, and here it just sort of shows that depending on whether you choose the Isotov and Twan helium abundance or the Olive Steigman Skillman or fields all of compilation of helium abundances, it sort of doesn't affect the estimates that much. And what we did was basically adopted a wide range of for the error bar that basically encompasses this discrepancy. So what is this? What is the implications for four neutrino mass modeling? Well, that depends on what happens to four neutrinos in the early universe. So there have been no phenomenological talks on this, but basically what you have to do is take this mass spectrum or this mass spectrum, plug it into this vacuum oscillation probability and also the MSW oscillation conversion in the sun, and fit the all the observed oscillation experiments and indications for non-oscillation as well. And so what you get is basically a real tension both for 2 plus 2 and 3 plus 1 models, more for 2 plus 2 models because of the lack of observation of disappearance in both the solar neutrino results and the atmospheric neutrino results. The limits on a sterile component to the products of the oscillation are very strong. 3 plus 1, I think, in my opinion, is more of a tenuous limit based on a combination of UJ plus CDHS, limiting the oscillation of this lower triplet to the upper, mostly sterile neutrino. And there's also this use of in a lot of the fits of a sort of a sum rule, which was shown by Passong and Weiler to not be used, to basically not apply. And nobody's actually addressed that, at least in the literature. So what does this mean for the early universe? Now you have four neutrinos, you have a 4x4 neutrino mixing matrix, you have many more angles than just a single active sterile case, which is basically what everybody had looked at prior to just a few years ago. And so the very conservative constraints of just forcing one, keeping that sterile neutrino from converting or being thermalized entirely with a non-resonant scenario, which is the most difficult scenario to thermalize if you had a resonant case with a delta M squared less than zero between the active and sterile. So if the sterile is lighter than the actives, you actually can more efficiently populate the sterile. So in the case, the zeroth order case of a non-resonant population, you have a pretty stringent constraint on a combination of the product of the delta M squared and the fourth power of the sine of the mixing angle. And it's a little bit stronger for electron neutrinos due to their participation in the weak interactions, in the nucleon weak interactions. And so the relevant amplitude, which I pointed out, was basically not, you don't have to worry about exactly what all the terms in the mixing angle are, or in the mixing matrix are. You only have to worry about the leading term in the oscillation, just like if you have a short baseline experiment to a long baseline experiment, what the early universe really cares about is the shortest baseline that the neutrinos are oscillating into, and that means the largest delta M squared, the leading oscillation. So that leading oscillation, for instance, could be through the fourth mass eigenstate in the 3 plus 1 model, and that could be effectively the mixing angle that you have to use in this limit. So you actually have to reanalyze now those three neutrino limits, or the effective number of neutrino limits from Big Bang nucleosynthesis or the CMB plus BBN. And you have to actually at least populate the three active neutrinos before you populate the fourth neutrino. And so you put a prior on this, and basically you find out the four neutrinos is still disfavored at 99% confidence level. And so once you get a precise determination of omega baryon from the MAP satellite, it's still comparable to that from BBN. Once you get down to the percent level, you could just marginalize over the baryon density as a nuisance parameter. And get that limit. This actually, the original work on this, I find this interesting, is actually on active sterile equilibration, was from an unpublished preprint in 1989. And then several papers followed after that. But the application for neutrino models were by Pasquale DeBari and myself. recently. And basically, even in this first paper in 1989, you see that all the regions that are favored now for oscillations are well within the equilibrium range. The LMA region, which is this adiabatic corner of the MSW triangle, and of course atmospheric and Allison Deere up there as well. Okay, we have to talk about that then. First of all, for 3+1 models, just looking at what happens here, for the leading oscillation is over the largest delta M squared, and you have this amplitude which has to be a product for the LS&D signal to be there. It's an indirect oscillation between the lower triplet through the large delta M squared and the sterile back to the electron neutrino, which is mostly in the lower triplet. And so this, and basically you need two large mixing angles with the sterile, and this forces a large amplitude mixing and a large delta M squared for at least two of the mass eigenstates, actually two pairs of the mass eigenstates, and it violates the BBN bound. So 3+1 models are out. 2+2 are a little bit more complicated because you have this sterile that's shared among four mass eigenstates. But in this case, you can also sort of break it up into what's going on with the leading and following oscillations. Both the solar and atmospheric neutrino experiments basically disfavor a large sterile component, as I talked about earlier, in their oscillation probabilities. And they're basically effectively appearance experiments. So this basically splits the sterile between the upper and lower doublet. You can't have it mostly residing in either the solar atmospheric doublet. So you can try to play games to basically decouple the sterile components here by setting certain of the mixing angles to zero. But you always have to preserve unitarity. So some of the mixing angles have to be large. And so, for instance, if you say do this case, these mixing angles would still have to be a half if you equally split it. And if you just look at the leading oscillations, if you ignore any inter-doublet oscillations, so you ignore the leading oscillation through the delta M squared of LS&D, but just look at the secondary oscillations between the atmospheric and solar doublet, those are still going to produce a large amplitude mixing, because either when you enforce the lack of a sterile component in the atmospheric doublet, and the lack of the atmospheric or the sterile component in the solar doublet, combined with the large mixing angle observed for the solar neutrino solution, and now CAMLAND. So both of them are basically going to equilibrate the fourth sterile neutrino component and cause equilibration, which is disfavored at 99% confidence level, and maybe more now with basically pushing the deuterium or the baryon density to higher values. So this really comes down to whether the mini-Boone experiment is, if it sees something, what does this mean for the early universe? Okay. So, of course, the zeroth order assumption is that it will refute the LS&D experiment, but really this is a stone that remains unturned, and of course there's the possibility that LS&D was actually seeing an oscillation signal. And so what does this mean for the early universe? It actually means quite one of several things, and it could mean that there's a pre-existing lepton number, which basically suppresses the effect of mixing angle in matter in the early universe, and suppresses the mixing so that the fourth neutrino is never equilibrated. Another way, a way to try to do this dynamically of generating a lepton number, is by introducing a fifth mass eigenstate, which resonantly can mix with the active neutrinos and generate the lepton number before the fourth neutrino is equilibrated. But it's because of upper mass limits from tritium endpoint even and cosmology, you basically are forcing that triplet down to low mass values, and you can't necessarily get a resonance early enough to suppress the oscillation conversion. There's another way through the generation of Majorana fields that can also produce a suppression of the mixing angle, which was pointed out just a couple of years ago. You can also, for instance, never reheat the universe to actually thermalize even the three active neutrinos and still get potentially the right primordial element abundances. And this is sort of getting weirder and weirder. You could have baryon and antibaryon inhomogeneities. And in this paper, they pointed out you could get, with the baryon abundance observed by the CMB, you could still get a number of neutrinos of 7. You could have extended quintessence models where you have sort of this dark radiation that actually acts as a negative energy density, which would counteract energy density, say, in a sterile neutrino. Or you could have a particle physics solution with CPT violating neutrinos, where basically you would just have 3 neutrinos equilibrated. So this sort of brings up another point of cosmological importance with sterile neutrinos involved, is whether the CMB large-scale structure and its limits on neutrino mass can be applied to sterile neutrino models. And this was actually recently a lot of hot debate in papers within the past couple of weeks on this. And basically, a paper pointed out that the value that the sum of the neutrino mass limit from the Spergel WMAP paper gives 0.69 eV, and that number is smaller than the square root of 0.9. And so for neutrino models, particularly 3+1 models, which they consider the only viable alternative, are ruled out by the WMAP value. So that's basically just taking both the 3+1 fits and this number at its face value. And so to me, this is actually one of the most tenuous analyses, because the wiggles in this curve come from an assigned systematic error on the Bugey experiment. And they basically assign a likelihood function based on a Gaussian on one curve that the Bugey experiment provides, which pushes this, when combined with CDHS, to very small mixing angles. And then secondarily, and I think most importantly, this is actually really controversial in the cosmological community. So this paper has actually generated many counterpapers, for instance, see Seljak et al., for the application of the Lyman alpha bounds. Hannestad redid basically their analysis, but with more relaxed constraints on their handling of bias between the galaxy power spectrum and how that relates to underlying matter power spectrum. And we're currently working together with Dodelson and Gates, basically showing that if you take the relaxation of the running that they imply, which actually is right here, if you take this running that they imply to see, and you combine it with their neutrino mass limit, you actually alleviate both. Well, you still actually see a running of the power spectrum, but the neutrino limits are actually a lot less stringent than they were before, about 1.2 eV instead of 0.69. So there's quite a bit of uncertainty in this limit, particularly in their application of the Lyman alpha forest. They actually, to use the Lyman alpha forest, you get a flux power spectrum from the type of bumps and wiggles that David Teitler showed. You get that flux power spectrum, and then you have to infer a matter power spectrum on that flux power spectrum. So you can do that with hydrodynamical simulations of a flux power spectrum, combining hydrodynamics with dark matter. And you can get a one-dimensional power spectrum for several different models. And then you have to infer that matter power spectrum based on those simulations. Then you have to go from that one-dimensional mass power spectrum to a three-dimensional power spectrum in order to combine it with the CMB and 2DF galaxy redshift survey, which is a three-dimensional power spectrum. And all those steps are basically questionable. So,
So that previous slide you have, the bound you're talking about on that figure on the left, is assuming that the upper fourth eigenstate is thermalized.
Right, that's another assumption. So if you have, say, a lepton number that gets you around the BBN bound. So this is already like basically a complication on top of the BBN complications. Several of these ways of getting around the BBN bound, which suppress the conversion, 1, 2, 3, 4. The first four basically keep you from thermalizing that fourth neutrino. So they actually fixed it. Yeah. These lines come from a combination of Bugey plus CDHS. Right. Okay, so this actually came up in the last talk, neutrinos in large extra dimensions. I knew it was on the schedule, so I don't think people heard me in the back when I said, hey, I'm going to talk about this. So basically the idea is this, and we heard quite a bit about it just 45 minutes ago. Basically, you have the active neutrinos which are on our brain, and they couple with some bulk neutrino which produces this whole spectrum of infinite number of neutrino states. And so this modeling was actually motivated by the fact in these large extra dimension scenarios you can have fundamental physics and the ultimate fundamental scale to be of order 10 TeV or 100 TeV or so, and you no longer have this heavy mass scale to suppress the neutrino masses. So this was an alternative mechanism to generate small neutrino masses, basically by having the volume factor provide the suppression. And so you basically get out Dirac type mass terms in these bulk type models. And then the simplest case that we looked at, which was one of the cases that Keith Enos just talked about, was where you have this type of mass matrix. Okay, and there's been quite a bit of work on alternate type configurations with, say, effective Majorana type bare masses in the bulk. But what we looked at was this was actually a couple of years ago. We looked at the simplest cases where you have a solution for the solar neutrino problem of the type that Duvalli and Smirnov pointed out. So recent work on fitting experimental laboratory constraints on these neutrino mass models are in these papers by Mohapatra, Perez, Lorenzana, Human Davuti, Longacker, and Perlstein. But actually, the laboratory constraints are still not as good as the cosmological constraints, albeit the cosmological constraints are on this one specific model that we looked at. So what you have to do is you basically have to find how these neutrinos, they're basically an infinite number of serial neutrinos instead of just one. You have to look at how they're all populated. And this effective population rate is what you have to keep in track of for serial neutrinos. And so what happens with serial neutrinos, and I'll get to this a little bit later as well, serial neutrinos, unlike other particles, are not in thermal equilibrium and then at low temperature decouple from the plasma. But quite the contrary, they're actually decoupled from the plasma early and then come into equilibrium and then fall out again due to suppression of the mixing angle due to thermal effects. So so you have to do this for all the modes in the neutrino sea in the bulk. And you also have to worry about the fact that the bulk neutrinos also decay, both to modes in the bulk and also on the brain. So you have to put that in there as well. So we did all this and found that this parameter space of Dirac mass for the active flavors and the size of the extra dimension, you basically can screw up almost everything in neutrino cosmology depending on your parameters. So you can get the density of the universe wrong and produce basically a closed or a short lifetime universe. Due to radiative decays, you can actually over-photoproduce deuterium and lithium. You can also violate the BBN bound of the number of neutrinos being greater than 4. You can violate the boomerang bound of the number of neutrinos not being greater than 13. And future MAP and Planck bounds actually reach even further up into this plane. So if, at least in these specific models of extra dimensions that we looked at, the bounds on the size of the extra dimension are the most stringent. So this sort of, I mean, this this uh, excursion into large extra dimensions sort of, you know, goads you into thinking what lies beyond potentially if there is this one sterile neutrino, if Minnie Boone does confirm LS&D and sees a sterile neutrino, what lies beyond that? Is there really only just one sterile, or is there like a fifth or a sixth or a seventh or an infinite tower? And so it could be that that these extra neutrinos that lie out there potentially could be the dark matter. And so that's the last thing I want to talk about in my 10 minutes here. Basically, sterile neutrinos could be the dark matter, and one of the original motivations actually for sterile neutrinos being the dark matter was a potential problem with cold dark matter on small scales. And so what warm dark matter does is actually suppresses structure on small scales, which may alleviate the fact that, say, a halo, a galaxy-type halo in simulations has 500 or so satellites, while we only see a dozen or so in our local group. But this is still basically in galaxy formation really controversial, because these dark halos may not necessarily be populated with gas and stars. They just might still be there. But nonetheless, sterile neutrinos could be warm or cold. And so in order to do it correctly for large mass sterols, which would be cold, you have to follow this. This basically is a similar equation for the bulk case, but just one sterile. And you have a production. And this here you can see how basically they're not coupled at high temperature. They decouple due to thermal suppression of the mixing angle, and then they come into equilibrium and then fall out again. And so at this period is when they get populated, and exactly when they get populated depends on their mass, more massive at higher temperature. So what you have to worry about at higher temperature is the fact that the QCD transition is occurring right there, right when the sterile neutrinos are getting populated. And so this is just really basic QCD early universe thermodynamics in a book that's almost like classic now. And so what you have to do is basically calculate how the sterile neutrinos are produced in this evolving background. And what George Fuller and I and Mitesh Patel did was basically find this production as a general with general lepton number in the universe. What happens actually with a non-zero lepton number is you can get resonant conversion, so that the sterile neutrinos have a really weird distorted spectrum, and they actually become colder than thermal. And so this happens for the contours here and here. These are contours of constant critical density, a fraction of critical density in the universe for basically a zero lepton number case, a lepton number 0.01, and a lepton number 0.1. And so this is basically the range that you can have sterile neutrinos produce dark matter, but then there's also limits, and basically the limits that apply that are most stringent are what's on this plot. And so WMAP, one of its most significant results and new results is the fact that it sees reionization at a really early time. And it's even difficult for cold dark matter models to produce stars at an early enough time to basically reionize the universe at a redshift of 15 or 20 or 30. And so one of their conclusions is warm dark matter is out, because you basically don't form structure early in warm dark matter models, because it's in cold dark matter you have this top-down scenario of small halos forming and then larger halos. So if you get rid of those small halos, you just don't have structure early on. But it's too early to call for the death of the sterile neutrinos as dark matter, because basically everything above this line acts as cold dark matter, and I'll show you that in a future plot. Might be the next one, yeah. So the lower bounds on the mass, when is warm just too hot here? So Goldilocks likes her soup just right. And so it has to basically, at least in terms of what it does to structure in the Lyman alpha forest now, this is a calculation of hydrodynamical calculation of several models with warm dark matter and cold dark matter. And here they actually calculate the flux power spectrum. They don't infer any three-dimensional power spectrum. So in a warm dark matter model with a KeV standard SUSY-type dark matter particle, you basically can't differentiate the red line from the black line here. So basically a KeV dark matter particle it basically behaves as a cold dark matter particle. And sterile neutrinos are a little bit warmer than a SUSY dark matter candidate case, so you have to take that into account. They have to be a little bit more massive. So what this means for gravitinos is about 0.75 KeV or so, For sterile neutrinos is 2.6. Now, if you want them to be basically dead on for CDM, it would be about 1 or 3 keV. Okay. So if you take into account all the possible constraints on sterile neutrinos, they can also, I mean, as with the bulk case, they have regions of parameter space where they mess up almost everything in neutrino cosmology. And the main constraints that do limit it are effects on the X-ray spectrum, these lower bounds through the Lyman alpha forest and reionization, and potentially effects in supernovae. We also looked at what happens to the CMB, the diffuse background, BVN, and those are basically all there, but they're in regions of parameter space that are outside of other bounds. How do you get a mixing angle that's maximal? So there's no theoretical motivation. So it's basically there's no theoretical motivation in sterile neutrinos, say with a SUSY partner type weak interaction, where basically you get the right abundance by just setting the SUSY partner's interactions to the weak scale. It's more like axions, where you have this narrow band of axion parameter space that could be the dark matter. So okay, so one way you could actually get this, and if you want to actually search for this dark matter candidate, is to look for kink searches in nuclear beta decay, where you'd have a kink in the beta decay spectrum at the mass of the particle away from the endpoint. And this was actually discovered. The 17 keV neutrino came up earlier today. But so basically, this is one way you would do it in the laboratory. But this is actually where they actually all lie in terms of the parameter space for sterile neutrino dark matter, would be in this range. And they're all orders of magnitude away, at least 3 orders of magnitude away in sensitivity to probe that parameter space. So the Nobel Prize last year went to neutrino cosmology or neutrino astrophysics and X-ray astrophysics. And there may be actually a connection between neutrino astrophysics and X-ray astrophysics, other than them sharing a Nobel Prize. And that is that these sterile neutrinos, if they are the dark matter, would have a radiative decay mode that's just a standard process. And their lifetime is very, very long, but as actually constrainable. And one way is actually through the resolution of the X-ray background, which actually prohibits the dark matter in basically diffuse decay in X-ray detection. So you can actually calculate what the diffuse background would be in the sterile neutrino dark matter case. It's about, if you assume dark matter isotropy, a redshift of 0 in our sky, which is definitely not the case here, then you would have a lower bound of about 2 or 3 keV. But definitely dark matter is pretty isotropic by redshift of 10 or so on the sky. And then the bound goes up to about 20 keV. The best bound actually comes from looking at isolated halos of dark matter with the gamma ray telescope. This is a very small number, but you beat it down by looking at about 10 to 70 particles in your reservoir, which is basically a galaxy cluster halo. And so you can do this either with Chandra, Constellation X, or XMM-Newton, they have a picture for. And the best bound, actually, on sterile neutrinos, upper mass bound, comes from observations of the Virgo cluster. If you had a 4 keV sterile neutrino as the dark matter observed in that cluster, you would basically produce a neutrino line, which is barely detectable above the thermal emission of the gas. And here, if you have a 5 keV neutrino, you have this whopping line. It's way above the thermal background. This is actually observed by XMM-Newton. You can look at 2.5 to 3 keV, and there's no excess emission above the thermal expected background. So basically, there's an eminent exclusion or detection of sterile neutrino dark matter. Now this bound basically for the zero lepton number case goes from about 3 keV to 5 keV, and is easily filled in by future observations of X-ray telescopes. So there's very little time to talk, but I just wanted to say that George Fuller and I are pretty optimistic guys. We like to think about what will happen after you detect this dark matter, and what you'll be able to do is actually probe the QCD transition. And so in the QCD space, it's believed that the early universe lies in this crossover, but it's possible that actually there would be a first order transition, which basically affects the dynamics, the time-temperature relationship of the early universe early on. And what that does is basically change the relationship between the dark matter density strength, the energy and strength of the X-ray line, and the parameters of the QCD, of your QCD model. So basically, if you look at, if you find this, the strength and energy of the line, you're probing QCD at high temperature. Lastly was the astrophysics part of my talk, but basically, we heard some great talks on supernovae physics and neutrinos in high density, or basically neutrino environments in the high density of supernovae. And inside a protoneutron star, you basically, a neutrino has a random walk through the through that neutron star because it's basically in thermal contact with the entire thing. And this is actually greatly exaggerated neutrino walk through the protoneutron star. I think the path length is about 1,000 times more than it would be. But eventually it escapes. And each time it scatters, it would actually have a probability of scattering into a sterile state, sort of just like in the early universe. And so having a sterile state of the type, say, that would be the dark matter, actually would provide a cooling mechanism for the supernova beyond the normal neutrino cooling, and then actually could occur very deep inside the star. But of course, only 1% of the neutrinos are responsible for reactivating the shock. So it's possible you would lose 80% of the energy to sterile neutrinos and still be okay. But this is all, a bit speculative. One of the key issues, though, is actually you would actually suppress that conversion into a sterile if you have a very large lepton number in the protoneutron star, which you would have if due to deleptonization, you would have a large number of electron neutrinos versus antineutrinos. So if you have a large lepton number in the protoneutron star for a long time, you would suppress this and get out of this bound. But the dynamics are unclear. So it could be that the supernova constraints basically wipe out the entire region for sterile neutrino dark matter, but that's still questionable. So in summary, sterile neutrinos could arrive in several extensions of the standard model. There's some experimental motivation for that. Minimal models of the Big Bang nucleosynthesis are in conflict with four neutrino models, accommodating LSD plus solar plus atmospheric results. And so if LSD is verified, it basically will not only require new particle physics, but also completely new particle physics or new physics in the early universe. Neutrino cosmology actually places some of the strongest limits on large extra dimensions containing bulk neutrinos. And so that's actually, I think, is something really interesting to apply to current models with large extra dimensions and neutrinos. The CMB large-scale structure and Lyman alpha constraints that are derived on neutrino mass, or I think, should be carefully interpreted. More massive sterile neutrinos are viable, detectable dark matter candidates, and when they are detected, they could probe the QCD transition. Thanks.
Questions?
Yes. So, when the sterile neutrinos produce gamma rays, is there a range of redshift forward in which these occur, so there is some washing out of the energy of the signature?
Yeah, so they're basically over a very large range of redshift that the neutrinos are decaying, and so you wouldn't have just a line; it would be a very broad spectrum, right?
I missed the connection to the QCD phase transition. It's just the rate of expansion at that time is also the decoupling time of the sending neutrinos, so it determines the
amount. Right. It's not the decoupling time, but the coupling time. So yeah, you have to sort of get out of the picture of something being thermally coupled and then decouples. It's basically exactly where the sterile neutrinos couple and then decouple shortly afterwards is exactly the range where you expect the QCD transition to be occurring. And so it's just a coincidence that these two very different phenomena are occurring at the same time. And right, it only occurs for the sterile masses that are actually viable as dark matter candidates,
which are
from a few kV to 10 kV or so.